good afternoon and welcome to A Closer Look on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Beattie Trantina. As the Iditarod mushers are closing in on Nome, the race is moving faster and faster every year. But author and old-time musher Rod Perry from Chugiak remembers the first time the Iditarod was run back in 1973. He spoke with KSKA's Ellen Lockyer.
I was one of the pioneers. Out of half of the state's population between Seward and the Matsu Valley, there was not one other person with any faith it would happen, with any interest in it, or any preparedness to run the very first Iditarod, and so I did that. My name is Rod Perry.
And you're an author.
Yeah, absolutely.
What'd you write?
I set out about 3 years ago on a quest to do the two definitive works on the Iditarod Trail. I've finished the first volume. It's out and available. I'll just tell you the website's www.rodperry.com. It is the definitive work on how the old Gold Rush Iditarod Trail was born.
What's it called?
Trailbreakers. Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod. And the subtitle to Volume 1 is Blazing the Last Great Gold Rush Trail in North America, 1840 to 1930.
And then what about Trailbreakers Volume 2?
Volume 2, same title, Trailbreakers Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod. And Volume 2 is Founding the Last Great Race on Earth.
And was the first last great race the one you were in?
Yes.
Tell me, how'd you get involved in it?
Oh, I guess I was a hopeless romantic even as a kid. I think I had dropped off the assembly line up where there is no time for about maybe 100, 150 years. So I was born too late to explore the American West with Bridger and Smith and Fitzpatrick, and about 100 years too late to open Alaska with McQuesten and Harper and Mayo. But anyway, I saw as the first Iditarod, kind of the equivalent. All of a sudden, I could join Lewis and Clark like John Coulter did, and I was just tremendously excited to go on the first Iditarod. It sounded to me when I first heard about it like the wildest, devil take the hindmost, hell-bent for leather adventure you had ever heard of, and it was just what I came north to find.
So you did it your way. You did it Rod Perry's way. And how did you get into mushing? Did you know about mushing before you came to Alaska?
Yeah. My dad had been up here on a big project helping build a power plant at Eielson in 1951. He was a bricklayer. He had been a trapper and a mule skinner and a timber faller and everything in his youth. But his hod carrier was Alan Rock of Point Hope, who became the greatest whaler on the Eskimo coast. His brother, Howard Rock, is one of the most famous natives ever born. And they had a third brother, Ibrulik, that my dad sponsored to come in. He heard from Rocky that Ibrulik had a fast dog team. He sponsored him. He had to drive his dog team 300 miles just to reach the little burg of Point Hope to fly into for the North American Championships. He broke the track record. Three others, though, broke it in front of him that year. It was a fast track. And so I heard all about sled dog racing from an early age. And then I came up. I was making a motion picture. My father was the subject. It's about an old trapper prospector attempting, without a lot of success, to continue on with a vanishing lifestyle in a dying old-time Alaska. He's on the cover of Volume 1. But anyway, the old-timer had a dog team. So I'd had a dog team for several years before the first Iditarod, and was involved in driving dogs in the bush.
So whereabouts in the bush now?
Well, all over as we filmed, but one place that I lived after the first Iditarod was Lake Minchumina. When I came out for the 77 Iditarod, I had to come with a little group. We brought my dog team out 175 miles just to get to the nearest highway. It was almost 18 days, map and a compass in my left hand and an axe in my right on snowshoes ahead of the dog team, breaking trail and cutting our way through to the highway.
That's sort of a strain on the dogs before a race, isn't it?
Well, you've got to, it's just like a human athlete. You've got to work them. Mm-hmm. So, they were tremendously conditioned coming out of there.
So how did you get involved with the 1977, the first Iditarod?
No,
you were out in Minchumina, right?
Yeah, that was. But 73 was the first I did a ride.
73,
yeah.
Okay.
So I ran several of the first ones.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
How'd you do? Well, in those days, it wasn't so much a speed race as it was a...
No, it wasn't. We were trying to go as fast as we could, but the trail wasn't as good as it is today. The dogs were not nearly as fast. The dog food was not nearly as good. We just didn't know nearly as much. There's been just like in any racing, you know, Olympic sports or anything, and there's always an increase in speed.
Well, what were those early Iditarods like? I know you ran with, Carl Huntington, the Mackey, Dick Mackey, the original Mackey.
Dick was on the first race. Carl wasn't.
Joe Reddington?
Joe wasn't on the first race. He was scrambling for dear life in town, panic-stricken. There was no prize money, and he was seeking to get it. And the way that came about, Joe and I used to talk about it. It has never seen print until my second book. And it is amazing. And I won't tell all in the book. I've got it well disguised, the parts that I want to disguise. But I tell the story of how the prize money came to be and what saved the Iditarod.
Well, you know, they said, I read Dick Mackey's book, 1 Second to Glory.
Yes.
I loved that book.
Sure.
It was ghostwritten, but I had fun reading it. But I remember the comment he said, the first Iditarod, they had three rules, and they wrote them down on the back of a brown paper bag. And when you look at the race now, it's overwhelming, the amount of stuff you got to do just to be in the race.
Right.
What's your spin on that? What do you think of that?
Oh, well, I think it's wonderful, the evolution, but that the important thing about the first race that if you weren't there, you would miss, and also virtually no one but Dick, myself, a few others, there's only a handful of people that were in on it enough to know how fragilely it was put together. It was just stuck together with chewing gum and safety pins, and it could have crumbled at any time out from under us. There were a few of us that knew about that. And there was, you would think today, as recent market surveys have showed, that it has become Alaska's most marketable product. And the word Iditarod, Alaska's most single marketable word, that website in the 3 weeks surrounding the race gets not a 500,000, but a 500,000,000 hits. It must be one of the biggest sites on the World Wide Web. It's a multimillion-dollar industry. It has spawned heroes. It has spawned lifestyles. It's been wonderful for Alaska. It energizes it, but it all... could have crumbled so easily, and that first Iditarod paved the way for everything that we see today. Everything that has happened was hanging in the balance on the first Iditarod.
Well, what was it like? That's what I want to know.
There were six fantastic questions, mountains, that could not be answered unless you ran the race to find out. And unless you had the money to finance the race, you couldn't run it to find out, but the six questions kept from raising the money. And the questions were, number one, well, they weren't questions, they were assertions, and mainly from the established dog driving community. Number one, the dogs can't possibly run 1,000 miles, it'll kill them. They'll all die. And, I mean, what sponsor would want to touch that one with a 10-foot pole? Number two, you'll never, ever be able to get through. Even if the dogs could make it, the mushers and teams can't make it through. That area had not been traveled for so many decades that it was almost like it was unexplored territory again. We didn't know what was out there. A picture that probably demonstrates it better than anything else, as team after team left and disappeared as if into the maw of a waiting, crouching, savage wilderness, just merciless and cruel out there. These two women standing there crying. Both of them thought there was a very good chance they would never see their husbands alive again. You should have seen the things that were on the sleds that were never seen again. We didn't know what to take. And we were experienced outdoorsmen. The like of that field has never, ever been seen again. The last of the great Eskimo and Indian dog drivers that had driven dogs for since time immemorial, out of necessity, not just because they wanted to keep a dog team after they had a snow machine.
Yeah.
And homesteaders and trappers and miners from the bush, the near and far bush, were there. It was an amazing field. But the next big mountain was, you'll never put in 1,000 miles of trail. Look how much trouble we have just putting in 25 miles for a rendezvous trail right here in Anchorage.
Well, how did they put in the trail? They didn't have the Iron Dog in those days.
Oh, yeah, they did. General Geddes with the U.S. Army was a friend of Joe Reddington. He sent out a group of 10 snow machines and 13 men. And the admonition at Kinnick was, live if you can and die if you must. But if you don't make it to Nome and you survive, don't bother coming back. And so with the might of the U.S. Army, we had a trail. They didn't know a thing about putting in a dog team trail. But without that trail, we couldn't have made it. Then the other thing was, you'll never, ever raise the prize money, much less all of the money that it takes to put the race on. And then they said, look at the administrative, logistical details. It's such a mountain, you'll never, ever be able to handle it. And the last one was, the race will die an attention death once it disappears off the face of the earth into the timber at the end of Kinnick Lake and disappears from civilization. The media won't follow it, and people will lose interest. By the time it gets to Nome, it'll be an afterthought, and it'll die.
Well, there's always naysayers. Who are these naysayers?
Well, it was mainly the established dog-driving community, but then they affected the business community. And the other big thing is this. There are two ways to analyze or make a determination on the prospect for almost any new project. And they are academic and intuitive. The academic way is everything has to line up. Dollars and cents decisions are based on cold, hard fact, track record, proof. Well, there was none. It was a brand new concept. There was no track record. There was no proof. It was nothing more than intuitive speculation based on intangibles alone. And so those, Joe Reddington, the intuitive, was meeting with academics to try to get the race going, and there just was... finally, he just had to battle his way through, and it was a grand experiment. It was run on a shoestring, barely hung together enough to be possible to complete. And if we hadn't done it, there'd have never been another Iditarod.
But I want to know, what was it like?
It was wild. It was wild. The trail was crazy. Like I said, those Army trail breakers, they were heroes, but they had no idea what a dog sled and a dog team needed to get through. I remember whizzing down this steep hill on a side hill. Well, a dog sled can't side hill any better than a pair of skis. If you lay them flat to the fall line, you're going to go down sideways down the fall line. And this particular place, down the steep hill on a side hill, and it went right between two huge cottonwood trees, barely wide enough for a sled to go through. There were sled parts all over the place right there. And they went up the Happy River. Nobody in the old days ever went up the Happy River. It's so unsafe. They came into Rainy Pass, and my friend there, Al and Ann, the friends that ran the lodge that were caretakers, didn't know what was coming off, but they did see these guys come in, and the leader of the expedition was all shook up. He had just lost three or four snow machines. He had just lost them into the Happy River where they caved through. So the trail was crazy. The supplies were... they were sometimes there, sometimes they weren't. The fellow that won the race, Dick Wilmarth from Red Devil, Alaska, a total unknown, out of nowhere, never had one single package of his supplies that he had sent out were found at any of the pickups. He finally found them in Nome in one pile in Munson's hangar when he got there.
Oh, they were trying to sabotage him or
no,
what?
No, no, it just got missent. One fellow, Conrad Killiger from Point Hope, got into the race without having paid an entry fee, and he had no supplies out there. About 5 o'clock in the morning, probably about the third day of the race, my friend Al at Rainy Pass heard a knock on the door. Nobody came to Rainy Pass Lodge in those days in the winter. And he was surprised, and he rose up on an elbow. It was dark. He said, "Yes, may I help you? Who is it?" And the call was, I'm Wilmarth. I'm here with the Iditarod. And this is a main checkpoint on the race. I'm Wilmarth. I'm here with the Iditarod. Al replies, "Are they going to hold that?" Now, that's the first race at Farewell Lake Lodge. Plain lands and disgorges a couple of checkers. Stan Frost, the famous guide, is there. They brush him aside, move in, take over his lodge as a checkpoint. And, he just sort of stood back and put up with it. And it was just barely thrown together. We did not know whether we could make it through at all. And if it hadn't have made it, all that has followed in all these years, all the enjoyment and the fame and the money that it's meant to the state and the whole thing would right. have never seen the light of day.
Well, and then they didn't have, you know, 3 different kinds of sleds for the race. They brought one sled, a freight sled. Tell me what a freight sled is.
Well, a freight sled is meant to carry freight. It's going to be a heavier sled. And still, there was a lot of variation in the first race. Over time, it's worked itself out. You know what? Within certain parameters, there's been innovations and so forth, but certainly not the variation in the first race. Bud Smith got to Kinnick. He had run a race sled to Kinnick because you didn't have to carry much from Anchorage to Kinnick. By the way, the first 2 Iditarods are the only ones that ever went all the way from Anchorage to Nome without some sort of a stop in the middle where he went to a restart. And Bud had broken apart on this light sled, and he started thinking, holy smoke, is it going to be like out there? And so he didn't live far from Kinnick, the first checkpoint. Instead of taking off on the race with the rest of us, he raced home to his parents' homestead near Big Lake, and the whole family tore into the building of a sled. He built a behemoth of a sled, built of oak, 220 pounds. It was amazing. And Howard Farley of Nome had a beautiful 13-foot-long Eskimo freight sled. There was all kinds of other things in between. Dave Olson built a Northwest Territories-style toboggan. Nobody knew what it was like out there. We just didn't know.
Well, what did you bring with you? They have rules now of what the mushers have to bring, and they check for that at the end of the race. In your day, they needed all that equipment. What types of equipment did you bring?
Well, you had to have a certain amount of food for the dogs. You had to have a tie-out chain so that when you stopped, you could tie the dogs out. You had to have an axe, a pair of snowshoes, you know, basic survival equipment, a sleeping bag. Those items haven't changed much. Those are still, you know, pretty much the required items. Just make sense stuff that minimal for any traveler out there in case you got caught. And back then, there was much more of a premium on woodsmanship, trailsmanship. Today, the race is so blame fast, you could make, in some places, 3 or 4 checkpoints a day. Back then, you may be 2 days between checkpoints. And before all of the people from far-flung regions came and brought dogs together, there was such a vast difference in the quality, the speed of the dogs, that very quickly, the race spread out over hundreds of miles. And you would travel along with people that had teams about the same quality that you did, just battling the elements to work together to try to make it through. But a lot of times the trail was gone in front of you and you'd have to wade. I remember wading. I couldn't even go on snowshoes. I had to wade to feel the trail down about 2 feet below the surface. And so the dogs could follow me. Anyway, the first race was just so much different than the rest. And it did. Today, there is such a huge kind of presence on the trail of the media and the race officials and the trail breakers and rebreakers. And then the teams are so fast, uniformly fast, everybody's got a good team. And so that clusters the teams. You could fall and break a leg, and it won't be a half hour before somebody will be along. But in the old days, you'd find yourself in a big world of hurt. In fact, that's about what would happen. You'd find yourself. Nobody else is going to find you. It might be 2 days before somebody comes along.
So it was like Emmett Peter, right, who changed the race from what they used to call the two-week camping trip or the three-week camping trip to a real race. Were you there at that time?
I was making a motion picture at the time, and I finally could not go on the third race, and my brother went instead. So he was on that third race when Emmett broke the record and shaved about a whole week off of the finishing time. That was just unthinkable.
I want to talk about building sleds. I want to talk about your impressions of the race now, which you seem enthusiastic about it, and everyone's enthusiastic about it. You're right. The Iditarod is the iconic Alaskan event. Everyone knows the Iditarod. Everyone knows that word. You know, you're an old timer, and I sort of want to get at how it got from what it started with to what it is now. Is it too much now? I think the media coverage is insane now. And being a journalist, I've been on that race 7 times. I'm the first to say I don't know the first thing about mushing.
Right.
And I think most journalists don't.
No, they don't.
And so why are there so many of them running after that race?
Well, I see it as just incredibly intriguing for a number of reasons. When I said that Joe Reddington had an idea that was no more than intuitive speculation built on intangibles, that's right, it was. But oh, what intangibles they were. If you think about it, there is among our increasingly urbanized, high-tech society, this sort of, I don't know if it's a craving or a pull, toward a simpler time when life was less mechanized and lived closer to the earth. And in going back to this primitive means of travel, people find a connection to their pioneer past. There's a almost limitless market for nostalgia. And then you look at the trail itself. It oozes history and legend from every twist and turn. And unlike all the rest of the major gold rush trails of the Yukon and Alaska, the Iditarod is the only one that has never been paved over or paralleled by a road or railroad. And the retention of that wilderness state has preserved for the Iditarod not only its gold rush condition, but by keeping civilization at long distance, it has handed the race almost undiminished this age-old theme of man against untamed nature. And you wouldn't get that if there was a road running over the route and you're just running along on a trail beside the road. And then you add to that, in a world lost in a love affair with man's best friend, who among us can keep his heart from being stolen by those magnificent sled dogs of the north? And the other thing that Joe knew is that wherever Gold Rush trails, if you look back through history, wherever Gold Rush trails have taken daring drivers and wherever great races have been run, heroes have been born. And that was all so clear to Joe, and the marketing value, that surpassing marketing value, was also evident to him. But to the academic types, he may have been making his pitches to deaf, dumb, and blind statues with imaginations of stone.
But, like, what were your impressions of Joe Reddington? I've been told that he was disturbed that the snow machine was replacing dog teams in the native villages. What were your impressions of Joe Reddington?
I love Joe. I'll tell you, he was not flawless, like many heroes. Joe was really an end justifies the means kind of guy. But Joe and I spent a lot of time together. One summer we spent together buying, processing, and shipping salmon from the mouth of the Yukon. Spent time in the summer with him looking for the old Iditarod Trail. I just love the tar out of him. And I'll tell you, if people think this race is, when they see what it's become today, they tend to think, hey, it's just something waiting to happen. And anybody could have founded it. There was one man on planet Earth that had the vision and the passion and the drive and the focus, the willingness to bet everything he had. He had already lost his homestead once over another race, and only by an act of the legislature and Governor Egan did he get it back. He was willing to risk that all over again. His reputation, there is just no one else who could have done it besides Joe.
I sort of find it sad that so few natives now can afford to be in the Iditarod.
I would say a lot of us are from a more industrialized mindset, and we think in terms of science. The natives typically were more intuitive dog drivers, and just this almost genetic, inborn ability to read your dogs and relate to them and almost be part of the team that most of us can't match. But as it's gone on, it has become more and more and more scientific. And so it tends to reward those who are, more experimental and scientific and those kinds. And then, of course, we live closer to where you can get sponsorships and obtain money and those things. So.
Okay, well, that's an interesting concept, what this race will look like in another 25, 30 years. They'll have these genetically engineered dogs. They'll have bionic dogs. They'll have robot dogs, don't you think? Pretty soon.
Yeah. I remember a friend of mine used to say, you guys run a billy goat if you thought you could win with it. Yeah, no, they're just... But they are just getting faster and faster and faster. It doesn't take away from the race in the first race when you see the Eskimos come down out of the Arctic and the Athabascans from the interior valleys. And they didn't look like they stepped right out of a North Face catalog. They weren't fashion plates. They wore the clothing they wore every day on the hunt and trap line, and their sleds were worn, and their harnesses were trail tested. The dogs were dogs of the trail, and it was just all so, I guess, so very romantic. Just what people expected to see, I think. And you could mingle around while the mushers loaded their sleds, and you'd see the things that went in there, and you knew these people were headed into the unknown on a 1,000-mile trek where life might hang in the balance.
Rod Perry, author and Iditarod Trail musher, speaking with KSKA's Ellen Lockyer. Perry has two volumes of his book, Trailbreakers, on bookshelves. You've been listening to A Closer Look, a special KSKA program that takes an in-depth look at the people and issues that affect our community. An archived copy of A Closer Look will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. Thanks for listening to KSKA Anchorage.